I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. There have been 44 American presidents, but just 17 Supreme Court Chief Justices. That puts the current Chief Justice, John Roberts, in very exclusive company. In confirmation, he claimed he'd be neutral in deciding cases, but one legal analyst says he's balancing a conservative agenda with the court's image and his own legacy. Today, the life and turbulent times of Chief Justice John Roberts. Then, it's Friday, and a movie might be in order for this weekend. We've asked the film critics back to update you on the latest in indie, foreign, and documentary movies. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Well, speaking of major decisions, the U.S. Supreme Court will once again make a bunch of them in the weeks to come. Gerrymandering, double jeopardy, DACA, the transgender military ban. The court, under its Chief Justice John Roberts, will once again have a major say over this country's direction. Joan Biskupic, the legal analyst for CNN, is out with a new book on the Chief Justice that talks about the ways that John Roberts inserts himself into important cases. Yes, he's not always bipartisan. Joan Biskupic is the author of three previous biographies of Supreme Court justices. She's also served as a Supreme Court correspondent for The Washington Post and USA Today. Joan, it's nice to have you. Good morning.
Thank you, Steve. Good morning to you.
He comes off as pretty laid back. He comes off as friendly. Still, you write that he manages to rankle his colleagues, maybe most specifically Sonia Sotomayor. How so?
Well, it's interesting. There are many sides to Chief Justice John Roberts. And in one area where we've seen plenty of clashes between Chief Justice Roberts and Sonia Sotomayor has been on race and most recently on the citizenship question for the census. She was going in one direction earlier this week during those oral arguments, and he was going in another direction. But we've already seen that play out in prior cases where he, you know, both on a personal level and a legal professional level, they're very different. She is always bringing her first Latina identity to a case. Mm. I like to say that with her, her background is foreground. With the Chief Justice, he doesn't believe that his own background influences him on the law and that he's just, as he famously said in his 2005 hearings, just calling balls and strikes just as an umpire would. So they're very different in terms of personal style and approach to the law. And so there's clashes there. But then also, Steve, he's, as you know from what I wrote in The Chief, he's engendered some distrust with his colleagues on the right, in part because of what happened in the Affordable Care Act case, where he ended up switching votes twice.
You know, he says he just calls them as he sees them. He just calls balls and strikes. But you say in this book that perhaps that isn't exactly the case.
Well, you know, that was a metaphor that certainly appealed to President George W. Bush, who chose him, and then was a great headline during the confirmation hearings. But the truth is, for any justice, not just the chief or any of them, it's really hard to say there's a pure strike zone in the law because everything takes interpretation. There are many interpretations to the Constitution, which is actually a fairly short document that's been imbued with understanding, you know, more than two centuries worth of understandings on the part of the Supreme Court. And even in reading federal statutes, justices come at them in many different ways. So there's lots of room for interpretation. But I do have to say the Chief Justice John Roberts really does say, and I think he believes, that he's taking a very neutral approach to the law. And what I do in this book is show times when, yes, that probably was the case, but also times when it might not have been. And, you know, earlier mentioned the Affordable Care Act that had a lot of other things going on in the atmosphere. But also, you know, he has very firm ideas about racial remedies, such as affirmative action. He has very firm ideas about abortion and reproductive rights that now we've heard about from Kansas. So these justices come at the law in different ways. And the chief, who's now right smack at the ideological center mm-hmm. of this Supreme Court, mm-hmm. his views are going to determine the law of the land for many years.
Remind us about that Affordable Care Act case, because that was obviously a huge case that the Supreme Court issued just a few years ago. And in it, John Roberts did something quite unexpected. Tell us about how he handled that case.
Sure. Let's take your listeners back to 2012. It's an election year, and every one of the Republican presidential candidates is vowing to repeal the 2010 Affordable Care Act, which was President Obama's signature domestic achievement. And it also, you know, for the first time, was going to try to bring insurance to so many more people through two different key mechanisms. One was that individual mandate that most people remember that required everyone to have insurance by a certain year so that healthy people would be part of the entire system, and not just people weren't just buying insurance when they were sick mm-hmm. and going to the hospital. So that was one part. And the other part was this Medicaid plan that would extend Medicaid coverage to more people who are near the poverty line. And what happened when the court took up this case after three historic days of oral arguments was to first vote to strike down the individual mandate and to uphold the Medicaid plan. But the chief switched votes on both and ended up voting to uphold this individual mandate, which so surprised many of his conservative followers. Mm-hmm. But then again, as I said, reversed on the Medicaid plan. And what he did, Steve, was invoked a new kind of rationale. At least it was new to his conservative brethren. They hadn't voted on it in their private meetings. Instead of saying that merely that the individual mandate would have to be struck down because it exceeded Congress's power under the Commerce Clause, mm-hmm. he said it could be upheld under Congress's power to tax. And you might vaguely remember that. It got yes. all sorts of controversy. And in fact, then businessman Donald Trump, he wasn't even running for the presidency then businessman Donald Trump, you know, accused John Roberts of just playing to a popular view or playing to the, quote, Georgetown set to please people who were beyond the marble walls.
And by all means, he really surprised his conservative colleagues, as you pointed out, because he had argued, or at least had indicated, he was in a different place in their private conversations, right?
That's right. The way it works, and it, you know, the way it's working right now with this big census dispute, is they hold all oral arguments, and then at the end of the week on a Friday, they vote in their private conference about how they want the case to go, and then each side begins writing the opinions. And what happened back in 2012 is he had the majority opinion, and he was supposed to start writing that the law would be mm-hmm. struck down because that's where the majority vote was. And he had some second thoughts for a range of reasons that I spell out in the book. And as I say, ended up voting, taking the opinion with a five-justice majority that included, instead of the conservatives, the liberal justices to uphold that individual mandate.
So
and
why
it came after weeks of negotiations.
Why ultimately do you think he went that way?
Well, you know, what I say in the book, after talking to his mm-hmm. colleagues, and as you know, I spoke many times to him, and he would not tip his hand. But what I believe is that his concern was born, his move was born of many concerns. He used to represent businesses who were involved in the healthcare industry. He certainly was worried about his own legitimacy and legacy, and that was intertwined with concerns about the legitimacy and legacy of the Supreme Court. And, you know, and then I also say what, you know, I say perhaps he truly did have a change of heart related to congressional taxing power. I don't think actually that it was that entirely. But however he would explain it, and he wouldn't explain it beyond what he had written, the case, I think, adds a new dimension to him as someone who always insisted he decided cases based on the law, that he was just calling balls and strikes. But the other thing I want to say is that despite all the anger that he provoked inside the court and, anger on the side of his conservative brethren, more confusion on the side of his liberal colleagues. But in some ways, you know, maybe this was what was best for the country, that this important law was allowed to stand. So he had heard from many people after that, you know, thanking him for doing what he did. So I don't present it as anything that was necessarily good or bad. I just reveal what he actually did behind the scenes.
Joan Biskupic is my guest. She's the legal analyst for CNN. We're talking about her new biography of Chief Justice John Roberts. So this notion that the court is split along partisan lines, not unlike Congress, this does present then a particular problem for the Chief Justice, if I'm hearing you correctly here.
It does. In fact, you might remember, Steve, back in November when President Trump was dismissing a ruling by a judge out in California, he referred to that judge as, just an Obama judge. And that so provoked Chief Justice John Roberts that he issued a statement that said, there are no such things as Obama judges or Trump judges or Bush judges or Clinton judges. We're all judges trying to make the best decision for all. And if he has struck that theme once, he's struck it 100 times. John Roberts Right. does not want you or anyone else to think of them as partisan or to think of these jurors as identified with the presidents who appointed them. But the truth is that the five most conservative justices on the Supreme Court today were all appointed by Republican presidents, and the four most liberal were appointed by Democratic presidents, and they often split that way. And we saw that even this week when the justices were hearing the question involving whether the 2020 census would have a query mm-hmm. asking people about their citizenship, which many people believe would actually reduce the response rate and is a very important issue across the country. But the chief feels like the third branch should be set into a different sphere than the political branches. And, you know, certainly that's what the Constitution's ideal was. Mm-hmm. But when you have these highly partisan confirmation hearings and you see these rulings where they're deeply divided on partisan lines, he can be fighting an uphill battle with what he's asserting now.
So what do you think, Joan, that the future holds here? I mean, does John Roberts, will he lean to his conservative roots? Does he work toward common ground more often than not and try to avoid having the court be seen as just this conservative bastion? What do you see happening here?
Okay, I think that's the exact question for our day. What will he do? Because he now controls so much. I do think he will inch to the left on some issues. He does not want this court to repeatedly be handing down 5-4 rulings
right.
on the most closely watched disputes involving separation of powers issues, involving race, involving religion, you know, all the culture wars issues that keep percolating back to the Supreme Court. He does not want that. But there are certain areas that are simply not negotiable for him. And one, I would say, is his view that racial remedies, such as affirmative action, do more harm than good. He has said that. He's famously said the way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. I don't see him changing much there. I do have to say, in the two biggest cases that we had from last year and this year, he might actually be part of a 5-4 court ruling for the president in Trump versus Hawaii of last year involving the president's ban on people coming here from majority Muslim countries. He was in the majority with his four conservative colleagues upholding that policy. Mm-hmm. And what we saw this week would lead many observers to believe that he would be in the majority and perhaps write the opinion upholding Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross's decision to add that citizenship question. So I, but those are very high profile cases, and perhaps in some others, though, he will try to lower the temperature and try to work for consensus across the aisle, so to speak. We've seen that in a couple minor situations so far this term, but not in the really big things yet.
Joan Piskupic's new book, The Chief, The Life in Turbulent Times of Chief Justice John Roberts. You still describe him as an enigma, and I'm wondering why. Ken Starr once called him Mr. Everything. Others have said he's an introvert who's learned how to act as an extrovert. I think I've known a few people like that. But why is he an enigma to you, Joan?
Well, here's the thing. I try to, you know, this book is 400 pages. It benefits from, you know, eight interviews with him, much of which he did keep off the record, but I was able to get a sense of him. And I'm glad you mentioned Ken Starr's reference to him as Mr. Everything. That he's referring to what John Roberts was able to be at this very elite prep school in northern Indiana. It was an all-boy boarding school. And I use, as I open the book, I quote from a letter that the 13-year-old John Roberts wrote to the school headmaster to get into that school, because I think that's an element that is defining of him. There's no mystery about his very strong sense of focus and persistence. And as he writes in this letter, he says he's always wanted to stay ahead of the crowd, and he thinks going to this school will help him continue to stay ahead of the crowd. Now, he's only 13 at that point. He says, I won't be content to get a good job by getting a good education. I want to get the best job by getting the best education. And sure enough, Steve, he goes to this school. And as Ken Starr says, he gets to be Mr. Everything. He's number one in his class. He's the first student to go off to Harvard. He goes to Harvard and does undergrad in just 3 years, and then he goes to Harvard Law School. And then a major moment for him, again, a revealing moment. So I'm sort of emphasizing the things that were revealing of him rather than that were more mysterious.
Right.
Another revealing moment comes when he hears Ronald Reagan give his inaugural speech in 1981, and John Roberts says, I felt the call of that. So I take all these pieces and I try to see how they influence his life now. And there are many pieces of evidence that I can put together. But when you talk to him or you hear him give his speeches, he's always so darn guarded. And the quote you just read about the person who's an introvert, who's learned to be an extrovert, came from a man who worked with him on the Harvard Law Review, who said, you know, he's basically a shy, reserved individual, but he's out there in this very public way. And one last thing I want to mention about his public side, you know, he was a fabulous oral advocate before the Supreme Court himself. He argued 39 cases. But I learned that his hands would shake violently before he stepped up to the lectern. And even when he was a younger man, he always had to fight a case of nerves. So as I said in the beginning, there are just many sides to John Roberts that make him a fascinating Chief Justice for our time.
I was going to say, what did you learn about him having the opportunity to interview him eight times over some 20 hours for this book? I was curious why he agreed to do that, first of all, and then what he gained by keeping those conversations off record.
Well, here's the thing. For any reporter, and you probably feel this too.
Absolutely.
Who likes off the record? We don't like it because it's, first of all, you're not getting material that you can definitely use in the book, but you're also vulnerable to spin because you can't test some of the things they tell you, because you know you can't go say, oh, well, so-and-so told me such and such, you know,
right,
that kind of thing.
Right.
But I think he wanted to engage in what lawyers call the process of discovery. I think he was curious about what I was getting from his colleagues and what I was getting from family members and childhood chums and just what my themes were.
So he could straighten you out, perhaps, if things weren't coming out in a way that he wanted.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. He wanted to influence my understanding of things. But so I went in there very guarded myself. These sessions were quite intense. And I kidded that if either of us had thought bubbles above our heads, he would be saying, I wish you would stop asking me these questions. And I would mine would say something like, I wish you were Justice Scalia.
Yeah.
Because when I wrote that book, he sat for 12 on the record interviews. But it served both of he wrote me a note later saying that, you know, he ended up cooperating far more than he thought he would. And I think in part because he wanted to know where I was going. And I was always telling him, I, you know, showed him the table of contents. I had him try to respond to what I knew about the Affordable Care Act negotiations. I wanted to talk to him about his attitudes on racial remedies. So I think he wanted to know where I was headed. And he's known me for a long time. And I know he had read my other books and was aware of what I do. And for me, even though we constantly had to negotiate over what I could actually use from in the book, it gave me an up-close view of how controlling he was, how
right.
guarded he was,
right.
and also a window into how his colleagues saw him in the cloistered chambers.
Yeah. Hey, how does he strategize behind the scenes? Because, and is it unusual for a Chief Justice to do that?
Well, I think that every member of the court who wants things to come out his or her way is always trying to figure out who can I get on my side? Who
mm-hmm.
can I work with?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that John Roberts has always, in his career, in his life, in his work now as a justice, is always thinking many steps ahead. And he's trying to bring people on board. But, you know, that's a tough thing. That's a tough thing to do with eight colleagues who were all appointed for life. And there's a rivalry over who thinks he or she is.
I think we've lost Joan Piskupic. She, again, is the author of The Chief, The Life and Turbulent Times of Chief Justice John Roberts. We'll hope to get her back perhaps another time to finish that interview. Time for a break. When we come back, the film critics will join us with the latest in art, independent, and foreign films. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, a KCUR reporter looked into two explosions at the massive ammunition factory in Lake City, Missouri. You can hear what he found and how workers are being put in undue risk at kcur.org/up-to-date. Monday on the show, a new bill in the Missouri Senate would change the definition of blight, and the House has passed what would be the most restrictive abortion ban in state history. We'll learn what the General Assembly is up to with just a few weeks left in the session Monday on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, the film critics are in the House, and there are so many interesting independent films we'll be talking about today. We're going to run the gamut here, folks, from a soaring documentary on Aretha Franklin at the height of her artistic powers to a film about a spaceship hurtling toward the oblivion of a black hole with a father and his baby daughter aboard. We're going to talk about all these films with our critics, and they are Cindy Haynes. Cindy, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Steve.
Steve Walker is here. Stephen.
Thanks for having me.
And
yeah.
Bob Butler, whose reviews you can read at butlercinemascene.com. Robert, how are you?
Happy Friday.
Lots of films here. Let's launch right into one I really, really liked. It's Woman at War. It's been brought back to town. It left at one point, but it was brought back because it's so darn good. Bob, it's in an effort to protect her homeland, a woman in Iceland becomes an environmental activist. Tell us about it.
Well, if you see any movie, the movies that we're going to suggest today, go see Woman at War. It's at the Rio.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to try to pronounce any of the Icelandic names.
If you can say the name of this actress, then you get 10 extra bonus points.
We're not going to
try. I've never seen a name like this before.
We'll call her Haldora.
Let's just do
okay?
that.
Okay. She's a middle-aged woman whose idols are Gandhi and Mandela, if you pay attention to what she's hanging on the walls of her home. She's a choral director, a yoga instructor, but she has another life where she goes to war against a local aluminum factory, and she is trying to prevent the destruction of some of the most spectacular landscape on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And what's wonderful about it, it combines political satire with social commentary and humor.
And it works
and
as a thriller,
it
too.
It works. Absolutely, it works.
I love that discrepancy between choir director by day and
yes.
at night. She's sabotaging electrical cables with bombs.
And it's really, it's fun because she could... She has something as low-tech as a bow and arrow and as high-tech as, like, military explosives. I mean, this girl, she has me in the palm of her hand. Yes. She's really out there.
And there's the story of her impending adoption of a four-year-old girl from the Ukraine, which is also just further humanizes her.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We should mention she plays two roles. She plays her own twin sister as well. So
it was a great twist at the end. This movie had me right out of the gate, and I hung with it for as long as it went. It was just a terrific film.
It was Iceland's foreign film submission, for whatever that's worth. But there are subtitles, so you know.
It's pretty amazing. There are at least a dozen movies from Iceland that have been released in the past, I don't know, half a dozen years. And for such a small country to produce such good movies, are many.
I saw another one about 4 months ago. I wish I could remember it. But yeah, good movies.
Okay, let's move on. That first film, Woman at War, it's at the Rio. Let's go to Stockholm, Bob. It's based on a hostage situation from 1973 in Stockholm, Sweden, that led to the naming of a psychological phenomenon as Stockholm Syndrome, when hostages develop an attachment to their captors.
Yeah, this is, I call this one Dumb Day Afternoon, because it has the same setup as the famous Dog Day Afternoon, but our hero, played by Ethan Hawke, who seems to be everywhere, is basically a moron. 1973, he walks into a Swedish bank. He's dressed as a cowboy with a fake wig and cowboy regalia with a big Texas flag on the back. Pulls out a machine gun, shoots the ceiling, and then turns on the radio to play Bob Dylan. That just sort of sets the tone for what is going to be a 3 or 4 day standoff. Over the course of time, he basically falls in love with Noomi Rapace playing one of the tellers there. It's part of it is thriller. A lot of it is just broad comedy, because this guy is such a hapless loser. You cannot imagine him hurting anybody. We have a clip here that this is him with a hostage negotiator.
This is from Stockholm.
We're sending in the gas, Lars.
Yeah, no, that's great. You just you pump the gas in, and then Erlof and Clara will die, no problem.
They will be just fine.
No, they won't be fine. They have
nooses around their necks, so when you put the gas in, they'll pass out, and then they'll be strangled to death, and it'll be your fault.
What nooses? I don't believe you.
The nooses I put around their necks!
Well,
okay.
Clearly there are no nooses. He's a sweetheart.
He doesn't do much comedy, Ethan Hawke, and he's fine in it.
Yeah.
But like you mentioned, Dog Day Afternoon.
Well, there's
made me just want to see that brilliant.
Yeah, it's
film
a vastly again. Better. Yeah, Dog Day is a vastly better movie. But
what's wrong with this one?
There's nothing wrong with it. It's just that after a while, you realize it's not going anywhere,
and it's absurd.
It's absurd. It's bland, and it's goofy.
It's not. It's not meant as a docudrama about this actual historic incident, although they drew upon it. It's pretty much a fictionalized account.
It was directed by Robert Boudreau in 2015. He directed Ethan Hawke in the Chet Baker biopic Born to be Blue. Mm. Now, that's a good film.
Mm. Was that a good film?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. This film was sort of so-so. It's Stockholm. Okay, let's move on to a film titled Family. Steve Walker, a woman obsessed with her career, discovers that a family can be found anywhere after she spends a week taking care of her insecure niece.
Right, and she is played by Taylor Schilling, who people will know from Orange is the New Black. She, this movie made me laugh out loud a lot, which a lot of movies don't. She exhibits some impressive comedic chops as this high-strung, alcoholic executive who barely knows her brother, much less his daughter, her niece, and she's entrusted against everyone's better judgment to watch her for a day, which becomes a week. So,
and Kate McKinnon is
Kate McKinnon is hilarious as a very uptight, high strung mom. Mm-hmm.
But do you know who stole it for me?
Who's that?
This Fabrizio Zachary Guido played this guy, Dennis, and he tried to sound hip. I mean, what was it that he was?
I wrote it down.
Bob, do you remember?
I don't.
I mean, sorry. He tries to be very hip.
Baby Joker.
Baby Joker. That's what he calls himself.
Her tough knot friend, Baby Joker.
Okay.
But the other thing that I liked about it, it sounds silly and it's a story that's been done before, but her niece is not LGBT exactly, but she's certainly not into ballet like her mom forces her to do. And she finds more refuge in the karate school next door to the ballet school. Hmm. And so Taylor's character makes a point to her brother and her sister-in-law that, you know, there's pushing and then there's nurturing. Yeah. And I think it did that well.
And there's another theme going on here. It has to do with bullying and family. And that's where this guy...
You liked it.
I did. I really...
Steve, you liked it.
I did a lot. Really? I did. Yeah.
I was more lukewarm to it.
Okay. That film, again, is titled Family. Okay. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking about the best indie films showing in town with Cindy Haynes, Steve Walker, and Bob Butler. Let's move on to a film here, Steve. High Life, a man and his baby daughter are survivors on a spaceship. They are hurtling toward oblivion of a black hole.
I'm going to defer to Bob,
I'm
going to
take this. The movie itself is hurtling toward oblivion. That's the problem. Directed by Claire Denis, who is a really good French director. Last year, she had a movie called Let the Sunshine In, which I admired a great deal. Okay, here's the problem. This is a no-budget science fiction movie. The interior of this spaceship looks like an office park that has been in bad repair. and it starts out with only two people aboard this ship, a little baby and her father, played by Robert Pattinson.
We don't know he's a father yet.
This is true. Then it flashes back to when there were actually other people on the ship. Apparently, this ship is heading on a scientific mission, a suicide mission to a black hole. All these people on board are criminals who basically were let out of prison if they would go on this journey, except for the doctor... actually mad scientist, played by Juliette Binoche, the great Juliette Binoche, who's trying to deal with her own infertility issues by artificially inseminating one of the other women, blah, 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 blah.
It's a mess.
The movie is an absolute mess that did not work for me, even on a metaphorical level, which is clearly where it was what it was aiming for.
I never thought I'd say this, but Juliette Binoche was terrible in this movie.
I didn't hear you say that. Robert Pattinson is in it, by the way, is
Twilight guy.
Mr. Twilight.
What's the clip we have here?
Well, this is Juliette Binoche talking to Pattinson's character. This will give you an idea of the coherence of the dialogue you can expect.
This is from the film High Life.
I know I look like a witch. I mean, you all call me Belshura, right?
You're foxy and you know it. I just don't understand how you can believe in your Class 2 mission. It's like you become a shaman of sperm. It's just a new religion for you.
Because I'm totally devoted to reproduction. Happy monk. Going to sow your fields.
Oh my gosh.
Yikes. Okay, I get the drift here. So that film was High Life, and you probably ought to find a different movie to go see.
I find the title to be ironic at best.
Okay.
Again, but Claire Denis has made incredible movies.
Yeah,
Beau Travail, we could go on.
I guess everybody's allowed a
goof. Yeah, everyone's
up now
allowed
and then.
A turkey.
How about this next film, which I think, Bob, you're a little higher on? It's titled Chaperone. In the early 1920s, a woman in Wichita accompanies a precocious 15-year-old dancer to New York, where the teenager becomes a silent film star.
Well, this is based on a novel by a woman who lives in Lawrence, Laura Moriarty. The novel got pretty great reviews. Basically, it's about Louise Brooks, Kansan, who became the idealized flapper girl of silent film. She was a major sex object way before, you know, Marilyn Monroe. The story is fictional. 15-year-old Louise is recruited by a dance company, the famous Denishon Dance Company in New York City, but her parents want a chaperone to go with her. So a Wichita housewife, her name is Norman, she's played by Elizabeth McGovern, trying to escape a bad marriage and a boring life, says, I'll be her chaperone. And it's about this uptight Kansas lady and this hell-raising girl going to the Big Apple and finding themselves in different ways. It is basically the older woman's story, which is why it's the chaperone.
I've heard more than a few comments from people that they had wished that the story had been about Louise Brooks.
Yes, except that she's played by Haley Lou Richardson, who I've liked in a few things, but she absolutely lacks this sort of man-killing sex appeal that this character is supposed to have. So when men are throwing themselves at her, I'm going, what did I miss?
And I thought McGovern, who I find in Downton Abbey, which is where a lot of people know her from lately, was never very good in Downton Abbey. She was the weakest link, for sure. But I really liked her in this.
Well, you know, this was written by Julian Fellowes, the screenplay did Downton Abbey. So I had high expectations.
And it was directed by Michael Anger, who
has done some Downton Abbey.
Right.
Here's the deal, though. I used to criticize costume pictures as being like, I would call them masterpiece theater productions.
This is
actually a masterpiece theater production, and production values are just chintzy enough that it put me off, too. So...
Mm.
But it's a nice portrait of a woman who feels invisible in her marriage for a reason that we learn.
And I think that's why the novel is popular, because it really appeals.
And she finds herself, and she meets some people in New York, and she actually says, you know what, maybe I'm not invisible. Maybe I have something to offer the world. And I think McGovern is quite good in this.
I sided with her, sure.
Okay, that film is Chaperone, and I'm hearing some sort of tentative thumbs up.
It's a waffle for me.
A waffle, okay. Is it going to be on your three to see at the end of the show?
I don't think so.
Don't think so. Okay. So maybe on Chaperone. Let's move on to Amazing Grace, Cindy. This is a stunning documentary that I want to see. I'm going to try and see it this weekend, featuring a live recording of Aretha Franklin's album Amazing Grace at the New Bethel Baptist Church in Watts, Los Angeles. This is back in 1972.
It'll be showing at the Glenwood Arts Theater, and make every effort to go see it as soon as possible. It's one of those independent documentary films that needs an audience right off the bat. Word of mouth is going to spread. This is an amazing experience to see her up close and personal.
This is Aretha Franklin at the height of her artistic power, right?
Right. There was a 25-member choir that was led by Reverend James Cleveland, who was a childhood mentor of Franklin's. 27-year-old Alexander Hamilton was hired to direct the choir. They rehearsed for a month. Sidney Pollack was hired to direct the film. This is in 1969. He made They Shoot Horses, Don't They? So he's riding on that reputation. And there was quite an argument about the fact that doing a concert film like this is much different than doing a feature film. The footage that Pollack shot, and Franklin was 29 years old at the time, was raw and it was visceral. On the second night of filming and recording, the audience included Franklin's father, Reverend C.L. Franklin, renowned gospel singer Clara Ward, and Mick Jagger and Charlie Watts.
Are they shown in the film?
Yes, they are.
You see them sitting out there, right?
They were in town recording an album. And
in awe, right?
Absolutely, from a clip I've seen, yes. So what happened is that Pollack did not synchronize the audio and the visuals. So they had a film that they couldn't show, and at the time they tried everything possible to, make it work. But it wasn't until certain digital technology was developed that they were able to synchronize that extraordinary voice with these close-up images. I mean, it's such an intimate movie.
But Aretha didn't like this film, at least
that's true.
My sense.
Yeah, because she felt that there was more emphasis placed on the director of the choir, more emphasis on her father, the other gospel singers, and there wasn't enough attention paid to her. So publicly she said she liked it. Privately she told family members she didn't want it released.
So how was it released?
I guess it was her sister who became executor of her estate, and she was shown the footage that they have that was synchronized, and she said the world has to see this.
Well, let's listen. We have a clip here from Amazing Grace.
Yes.
Cindy, what is it?
And she's just singing, I'm climbing a higher mountain.
This is Aretha Franklin in Amazing Grace.
I'm climbing
little sense of Aretha there.
Can we hear some more of that?
Just end the show now. Yeah.
Right. Actually, correction, it was her niece, Sabrina Owens, who insisted that it be released. And the album became the best-selling gospel record in history. Mm. And this documentary will make the list of the best nonfiction films of 2019, I predict.
And what kind of reaction are your friends seeing it? Are
they lit up saw by it because I went to the True False Film Festival.
Yeah.
And it was one of the hottest tickets you could find. So
okay, this is playing out at the Fine Arts Theater, 95th and Mission. It's playing at Liberty Hall over in Lawrence, right? Yeah, okay. That film, again, Amazing Grace. It features Aretha Franklin. Okay. Steve Walker, let's go to a film, Little Woods. Two estranged sisters living in North Dakota are driven to extremes while trying to survive in a hostile world.
This film is reminiscent of something like A Winter's Bone. It's set in rural North Dakota, probably one of several opioid den capitals in the United States. Two sisters, one was adopted, Tessa Thompson, who's African-American, the actress, and Lily James, who was also in Downton Abbey.
She's wonderful.
She's white, and they're sisters. They've been estranged because Tessa's been in jail.
Mm-hmm.
She was selling drugs when she wasn't selling coffee and muffins to guys at a work site. Anyway, she gets sucked back into the world. She is on probation. She's just shy of getting out from under that thumb. And then her sister kind of reappears. Their mother passes away, which happens before the film starts even. She's trying to decide what to do with the house. This is a movie about real people. Mm-hmm. And I could sense that there are hundreds of stories out there, whether it's North Dakota or 20 miles north of here, that are just like this.
It's about poverty. It's about it is in a very real sense about the opioid crisis. I mean, these workmen that she's selling the drugs to, these are guys that got addicted trying to treat injuries that they got on the job, and now they're in, you know, a deep hole. Mm. It's a bit of a social document in a way, but well acted.
Oh, I think it was just captivating. I really enjoyed it. So I know Cynthia loved it.
Yeah.
We have a clip here from Little Woods.
We do. It's Tessa Thompson, as Ollie is her name. She's talking to her parole officer, probation officer, whichever.
Let's listen to a clip from Little Woods.
How's the living situation?
Not great. I guess it's a good thing that Mom passed before we got evicted. Just have me to worry about now, so...
And how's your sister?
I haven't seen her much.
Well, even after...
Yeah.
You ever think about leaving?
You know, one of the jobs that I applied to is out in Spokane. So, I'm not just thinking about it anymore. Speaking of which, I need a reference, so I was wondering if maybe... What, is that stupid?
Not worried about what I'll say.
That sounds like real people talking the next room.
And the two actresses are amazing.
And I want to mention, this is the third film we've talked about today, directed by a woman. We hear so little about women directors getting any kind of chances.
And here they are.
So this is directed by Nia DaCosta, who's an African-American, very young woman, actually.
So women have been involved in Family, Little Woods, High Life, and Mustang.
Our next movie.
Oh, Mustang. Yeah, we're going to do Mustang.
Well, speaking of Mustang, that is the last film I hold in my hands here for this edition of Up-to-Date Film Critics. The Mustang, an inmate at a Nevada prison, is chosen to participate in a program to tame wild horses, Cindy.
This is one of those films that sort of came out of left field and is extremely popular. I think it's doing very well at the box office. It stars, okay, Bob, you're the best guy to pronounce his name.
Matthias Schoenwald? Something
Schoenertz.
Like. Schoenertz, that's it.
A Belgian actor with absolutely no trace of a European accent in this film.
He's fantastic. The question is, who is wilder, the horse or the inmate?
Mm.
I think he and the wild Mustangs are kindred spirits.
They are.
He's been in solitary forever. And
the horse is going to basically end up being shot because it's untrainable. And so the hopeless man and the hopeless horse are thrown together.
And that sounds so heavily metaphoric, but the movie doesn't play like that.
The movie plays like
all.
A documentary rather than a scripted drama.
Robert Redford's got a connection to the Mustang.
I think he lent his name and money because he liked the film so much.
Okay. And not only directed by a woman, but by a French woman. Go figure.
It's a very American West kind of picture. Yeah.
In fact, it opens with documentary footage of a Mustang roundup that is just absolutely beautiful.
Mm. I'd want to see it just for that reason alone. What's the clip we have here?
It's him talking to someone who works at the prison.
Connie Britton is like the prison psychiatrist trying to get him to cooperate.
This is from The Mustang.
Is your freedom important to you? Is that something you think about? Are you listening to me at all, Mr. Coleman?
Yeah,
you're listening, or yeah, your freedom's important to you?
I'm listening.
Okay. Thank you.
Just give me back
that. Hey, what? It's okay. Thank you. Sit down! I get it. You feel like you have no control in here. I get it. I understand that. I am giving you some control. That's what this is. And like it or not, you're going to be reintegrated into the general population.
I'm not good with people.
Okay.
That's
He's
true.
Not
That's
good
from
with people.
The Mustang, not good with people. Okay. Did you like it?
Yes.
Loved it.
Very
Loved
much.
It.
Okay.
Want to mention the Jewish Film Festival that's running through May 12th. Some fantastic movies to be shown. A website, thejkc.org.
Okay. And while we're at it, this Thursday, 6:30 at the Alamo Draft House, where exactly 50 years ago it first debuted, they're showing Sam Peckinpah's The Wild Bunch. That's
Wild
where
Bunch.
The notorious first public screening was held and grossed out an audience full of school teachers who'd come to town for an education conference.
We're going to be talking about that film next week with Mitch Bryan here.
Great.
If you had to pick just three films to recommend to our listeners, where are you going, Cindy?
Woman at War, Amazing Grace, and Little Woods.
Okay. So, Robert?
Woman at War, Mustang, and let's go with Stockholm.
Okay.
And I'm going to do Family, The Chaperone, and The Mustang.
Family, Chaperone, and Mustang. Okay. I want to thank Steve Walker, Cindy Haynes, Bob Butler, as always, for coming in. Yesterday in the show, we learned about the labor force that made the Kansas City stockyards hum. Their contributions helped create the city's first million-dollar industry. You can hear that conversation at kcur.org/uptodate. Monday, Grammy Award winner Rodney Crowell discusses his new Lone Star-themed album, which he'll be touring for soon in Kansas City. Our theme music is composed by the great Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Suzanne Hogan, Maria Carter, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.